are the antidote to right-wing radio, RadioLeft.com.
Well, radio lefties, conservatives seem to think it's only young people working their first jobs who are working for minimum wage. They couldn't be more wrong. Well, just look around you when you go to Wally World or McDonald's. In this part of the country, I see old people working these jobs as well as the young. With the price of gasoline being what it is and going higher every day, it will not be long until these people have to work an hour for a gallon of gas. Something is wrong, and it's greed. Most of us grew up hearing the words, the love of money is the root of all evil, but no time in our history has it been more apparent than now. Maybe in the days of slavery, but there are slavish ways being implemented today, and Rick Santorum is a prime example of a slave owner's mindset. Why, just look what George W. Bush and the PNAC cabal was willing to do for money. 1,500 dead soldiers and counting, not to mention all the hundreds of thousands of dead innocent in Iraq. We need a minimum wage that reflects the amount of back-breaking, mind-numbing work that people do. This is Miss Terry sending it back to you, Jeff.
Where investigative bloggers meet the media. It's Blog Call on RadioLeft.com. This is Jeff Steckles in the Radio Left studios, and we're going live to Blog Call, which is hosted by Bob Pertick of Democrats.com. Bob, would you like to introduce the show?
Hello, Jeff, and the audience of Radio Left. This is Bob Pertick, and I'm with Democrats.com, and I'm your host. The goal of Blog Call is simple. We're here to introduce the mainstream media to the most important exposés by progressive, investigative bloggers. Right-wing bloggers spread their smears and lies through Drudge, Rush Limbaugh, and Fox News, and usually into the mainstream media within minutes. And when the right goes on the warpath, truth is the first casualty. They lied about Bill and Hillary Clinton, they lied about Al Gore, and they lied about John Kerry. But the media broadcast those lies, which allowed the right to seize the American government. Then they lied about Iraq and seized that country, too, with the help of the media. Now they're lying about Social Security, lawsuits, bankruptcy, and everything else the radical right wants to destroy. Progressive bloggers are determined to challenge right-wing lies, so we're doing our own serious investigative reporting based on the truth. We're working in obscurity since the loudest media are controlled by the right, while centrist media are terrified of offending the right. All we have is the truth, which is why we're willing to stand behind our exposés, unlike the right. And that's why we're inviting the mainstream media to participate in Blog Call. We welcome the tough questions because we can answer them. Blog Call 1 featured John Arevosos of AmericaBlog.com, who exposed Jeff Gammon as a gay male prostitute, thus a criminal and a high security risk, who got within knife-throwing distance of the president for 2 years. Although John's expose has been widely covered in the past 2 weeks, progressive bloggers are still waiting for the mainstream media to answer the key questions, namely, who brought a criminal into the White House, why was he brought in, and what crimes and dirty tricks did he commit with his powerful White House connections? Until we get serious answers to these serious questions, we will continue that investigation. Today is Blog Call 2, and our featured guest is Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. Brad was featured in the New York Times yesterday and also on ABC TV discussing Apple's legal actions against bloggers who expose trade secrets. Brad, who's a very busy guy, is also challenging electronic voting machine manufacturers to add paper trails to their machines through his grassroots campaign at velvetrevolution.us. But Brad is here today to discuss his powerful investigative expose, the story of Clint Curtis, the Florida computer programmer who wrote vote-flipping software for touchscreen machines at the request of powerful Republican Congressman Tom Feeney. Brad is joined by Clint Curtis himself, who will also answer your questions. Our format's a press conference. Brad and Clint will speak for 15 minutes, then we'll have 30 minutes of Q&A, followed by 5 minutes of announcements. I'm especially pleased to report that Brad Friedman will be breaking some very hot news on today's Blog Call. So, Brad, take it away.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me. And just want to make sure, Clint, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Wonderful. Okay, let me give a little bit of background as quickly as I can here. This is a rather broad-reaching story, and I understand that many of you on this call may be familiar with the meat and potatoes of the allegations that I've been reporting since early December. However, there are probably also folks unfamiliar with it entirely, so I'll try to please everyone by giving some background, but doing so as quickly as I can. Clint Curtis, I heard from him in early December, either late November or early December, about his story, and interviewed him in depth for quite a while, and checked out as much as I could at the time about the claims that he was making before running with his story. In general, he explained to me and in a sworn affidavit that he was approached, well, actually, when he was working at a company in Oviedo, Florida, a software firm by the name of Yang Enterprises, Inc., or YEI, he had a meeting in October of 2000 with the CEO of Yang present, Mrs. Yang, her executive secretary, Mike Cohen, and a fellow by the name of Tom Feeney, who was at the time Yang's corporate counsel, Yang's registered lobbyist, and just happened to be the Speaker of the Florida House. Tom Feeney was also the running mate to Jeb Bush in Jeb's initial run for governor in Florida in 1994. He's also rather famous, Tom Feeney is, for being the one during the 2000 election to announce that no matter what the United States Supreme Court decided about Florida's electors, Florida's legislature would go ahead and give the electors one way or another to George W. Bush in 2000. So in this October 2000 meeting, Clint claims and has sworn to in an affidavit and later in sworn testimony, videotaped, and we have that on bradblog.com, before members of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, that Tom Feeney asked him to write a vote-rigging prototype software. He was very specific about what he required from this software. It had to be usable on touchscreen computers. It required that no additional equipment would be needed, for example, a keyboard. And most notably, I suppose, it required that the source code, that the routines used to flip votes not be visible if anyone was to examine the source code. Curtis has told me at the time that he, you know, explained that it couldn't be done without hiding, you couldn't hide the routines if anybody were to examine the source code. Yet he was tasked at Yang to go ahead and write this program anyway, which he did. It was a prototype program to explain how this could be done. Curtis at the time was a lifelong Republican and went about this task because he was under the impression that Feeney was concerned that Democrats would try to rig the vote at some point with electronic voting software, and Feeney wanted to know how to keep an eye out for that and keep that from happening. Clint went away and wrote this program. Well, he didn't go away. He went to his office in Yang Enterprises, wrote this software, and delivered it the next day to the CEO, Mrs. Yang, on a CD with documentation, telling her that it's, you know, a very simple program, explained how it worked and how generally the way it would work is you would touch certain invisible buttons on the computer screen and the software could be used in either voting machines or tabulating machines, which were in use at the time in Florida. And basically what would happen is when you hit these buttons in this specific order, if the candidate that you wanted to win was already leading, then no numbers would be changed or flipped, However, if you if your candidate, the candidate that you wanted, was not winning, then the numbers would be flipped to give your candidate 51%, and all the rest of the candidates would get 49% in the same percentage that they had before the flip occurred. When he gave that software to Mrs. Yang, he also told her that it was that he was unable to hide the source code, the routines in the source code, and at that time, he claims that she told him, you don't understand, you have to hide it in the source code, this is to rig the vote in South Florida. So, nonetheless, she took the software, went away, and at that point we're not sure what happened to it. Now, in the subsequent weeks, Clint became dissatisfied working at Yang based on meetings such as that with Tom Feeney, and eventually gave his resignation to the company, who then asked him to stay on until he could find a replacement for him, which he did, and he was there for another 6 weeks or so until they were able to find someone, at the end of which they threw him a big farewell party and indeed gave him a going-away card in which Mrs. Yang said, famously now, I guess, the door will be open for you anytime you'd like to come back. He left. He went to the Florida Department of Transportation, where he also began to see that Yang was, who had a big multi-million dollar contract with FDOT, Florida Department of Transportation, had been overbilling and doing all sorts of other things with their contract with FDOT. As well, and very importantly, Clint explains that there was an illegal Chinese alien who was working at Yang and who was inserting wiretapping modules into the software with sensitive contracts that, like those that they had with NASA. Later on, in the ensuing years, the man who he reported as being an illegal Chinese alien, Hai Lin Ni, or Henry Ni, was eventually arrested in 2004 after a four-year sting by the Homeland Security Department's Immigration and Customs Export Bureau, known as ICE. He was arrested on three counts of attempting to ship Hellfire anti-tank missile chips to the People's Republic of China. That was, I want to say, March of 2004. In the summer of 2004, Henry Ni pled guilty to one of those charges, and in the plea agreement, the court papers of which we've posted some of it on bradblog.com, Ni admits that, well, it had been a slow year, so they had only done this 10 to 20 times in the last year. Interestingly enough, in October of 2004, the sentencing against Ni for these what he admitted was 3 years probation and a $100 fine. It has come out just in February, and we've just reported it on bradblog.com, that the Florida Department of Transportation, who had been investigating this story, has now confirmed, in fact, that Clint Curtis was correct in that Henry Ni was an illegal alien as of January 2000. Interestingly enough, the feds would not tell the Florida IG's office whether Henry Ni was an illegal alien until their prosecution against him ended. As well, they found that Yang, in fact, did overbill FDOT and owes to the tune of some $300,000+. So one claim after another has been eventually verified, showing that Clint Curtis has been telling the truth about them, while the vote rigging charges specifically have been denied by Feeney and Mrs. Yang and Mike Cohen, who was also claimed to be in that meeting. Bradblog.com has been able to confirm, oh, I don't know, about 80-85% of the things that Clint Curtis claimed happened. Let me see. Clint, am I missing any major points in the story so far?
I don't think so.
Okay. Bob, anything jumping out at you that I haven't touched on here? Ah, yes, there is something. I suppose this will be part of the breaking news here. The original inspector from the IG's office, in the Inspector General's office in Florida. His name was Raymond Lemmy. Curtis went to him and gave all of this various information back in 2001, after which a few months later, both he and the other whistleblower who had reported on these things to the Florida IG were both summarily fired on the same day and without reason. Both of them ended up filing whistleblower cases, which they won. Nonetheless, in mid-June 2003, Ray Lemmy came to Clint, so Clint tells us, and explained to him, and I'm paraphrasing here what he has in his affidavit, but it's pretty close. He explained to Clint that the report will be ready in a couple of weeks. Lemmy says that he tracked the corruption, quote, all the way to the top, that Clint would be happy with the results, and he should keep his ears open in the next couple of weeks. 2 weeks later, on July 1st, 2003, Raymond Lemmy was found dead in a Valdosta, Georgia motel room about 80 miles from where he worked in Tallahassee, Florida. The police have ruled the case a suicide. And there's some troubling things about that case, not the least of which is that the police report says that though pictures were taken of the crime scene, there would be no pictures submitted with the report because of a failure in the camera's flash memory cards. Well, guess what we have? And we will be publishing today on bradblog.com. In fact, the photographs have been made available on the internet from the crime scene. They do exist, and we have confirmed they came from the Valdosta police. And most notably, and we'll have a complete story on this as soon as we get off the blog call, is ready to go, but I wanted to hold it for the call. The Valdosta police actually reopened this case, the Lemmy case, in December of 2004, and closed it shortly thereafter in either December or January of 2005, after receiving a call, or actually talking to, someone at the Florida Department of Transportation. I have been unable to get information from the Valdosta police about who they talked to at the FDOT and exactly what they spoke about, but in an interesting series of conversations with them, which I will highlight in the report that I'll post at bradblog.com after this call, you'll see that they had some interesting things to say to me and excuse me, and claimed not to be stonewalling me and would get back to me with quite a few troubling questions and inconsistencies in the police report. Nonetheless, for 3 weeks thereafter, they failed to get back to me, despite my having called them and paged them every day. We'll have details on that in the report on bradblog.com. I think I've covered sort of the meat and potatoes of the issue. I know that Clint has always answered anything that I've had to say, so I hope he'll be as open with all of you guys about any questions you may have on the case. I'll try and jump in where I may have details that he may not be as familiar with, given the fact that I've been following this paper trail, and it is an extensive paper trail over the last 3 years, at least, of all kinds of papers and things that seem to confirm various elements of Curtis's story. Bob, is there anything that jumps out that I have missed in that not as quick summary as I had hoped?
That sounds great. I want to move into the Q&A, but let me just say that if you want to get to Brad, his email address is on bradblog.com. I hope you'll everybody who's listening today will come back next week for Blog Call 3, Tuesday, March 15th, featuring John Byrne and Larissa Alexandrovna of RawStory.com. John and Larissa are exposing how Tom DeLay's extravagant trips overseas were illegally funded by a charity called NCPPR, and how NCPPR illegally raised its money by scamming the elderly with Social Security fright letters, and how right-wing lobbyist Jack Abramoff connects the two. That will be next week. Now, this is a press conference, so please ask our guests specific questions about this story and save your excellent opinions and rants for your blogs. Say your name and your blog or news organization, and keep your question under 30 seconds if you can. Everyone is muted, so unmute yourself by pressing 6 in a moment when I give you the signal. And then when you're done, press 6 again to remute to eliminate distracting background noise. Okay, go ahead.
Well, heck, I'm going to jump in here. This is James Moore, author of Bush's Brain, and down in Austin. I'm curious as to what sort of coverage, if any, this has gotten in mainstream media. I've read about it all over the net, but Clint, did any of the mainstream reporters in Florida kind of try to talk to you? Have any of the national publications dealt with this at all?
We have contacted them, but they haven't dealt with it yet.
There's been nothing anywhere written about any of this.
Nothing. We talked with the New York Times. We talked with Newsweek. We talked with a couple of television stations, but nothing yet.
Well, let me add that, in fact, they contacted, they contacted me, and they contacted Clint, and some very large media organizations have, I know, talked to me at length, and to Clint at length. There has been various coverage here and there, local papers and so forth, but yes, as far as the broad general media jumping in, there has been an extraordinary silence.
My guess is that one last thing, and I'll let somebody jump in, but my guess is when anybody asks to see this particular program or copy of software, they cite the Millennial Copyright Act and say it's proprietary, nobody can see it, blah, 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 or is... Has anyone ever, do you have a copy of it, or has anyone ever been able to verify that it is, in fact, extant?
Well, I reconstructed it, and it's posted on a website, so anyone can download it and play with it and anything they want to do.
The actual software, by the way, because folks have asked about that, was written at Yang itself, and Yang is a top-secret security clearance company, so that software was not allowed to... the original software was not allowed to leave the building, and of course anytime that Yang has been asked about it, they say that it doesn't exist.
Clint, what is your website?
www.justaflyonthewall.com.
Justaflyonthewall.com.
Right.
And that's where people can go to find the software that you wrote.
Right. They can download both they can actually look through how it's built, how it works. You can download the actual source code, play with it. It's all there.
Do you have any reason to think it was used in the 2000 election in Florida?
I don't know, but if Tom Feeney plays to win, if he could gain an advantage, he will use an advantage.
Would there have been time between the time you wrote it in October, between then and November 2000, for that to be installed?
Well, it's only 24 lines of code. You could add 24 lines of code to any program that's running and flip the vote with it. So it's not that tough. But at that time, what he was talking about is controlling the vote by keeping minorities away from the polls and that sort of thing. So I think he had other plans then.
Was Feeney aware of the felon purge scheme coming out of the Secretary of State's office?
He was bragging about it. That was part of his thing, he said.
Feeney was bragging about the felon purge.
Yes. He was going to keep minorities away from the vote, from the polls, and he was going to place police patrols, and he said he could reduce the black vote by as much as 25% just by placing police patrols in the right place. So.
Is this in your affidavit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he also talks about, he says that Feeney called it an exclusion list.
Right. Feeney was an exclusion list.
I hope there are people listening who have been following the 2000 felon purge story. Greg Palast, of course, has done all the heavy lifting on that story. And I don't believe anybody covering that story has looked at Tom Feeney and his role and Clint Curtis's affidavit on this. So I hope somebody will follow that thread.
Where can the affidavit be found?
If you, I have a list of all the sort of key articles that I've reported since December on the Brad blog. If you go to www.bradblog.com/ClintCurtis.htm, there is a link to his original affidavit and all of the various, as I say, key articles in this series as it's developed and as things have played out.
Could I also ask quickly how the media in Valdosta in Florida dealt with the death of Remy?
There, I have a link on that site, and it'll be linked again in the story that I run to an obit that was run. Other than that, there has been almost zero coverage of Raymond Lemmy's death.
Does he have a family?
Yes.
Have they been vocal about anything?
I speak about it in the report a little bit. I have spoken to family members, but they and there's different feelings amongst the family. I talked about it a little bit in my report, and none of them wished to speak on the record, but they did speak on background.
Can I ask about his report? Do we know what happened to it, where it is?
The report that Lemmy began in 2001 was just released, finally, in February of 2005, just last month. And as I said, it confirms that many of Clint's claims, as far as Henry Nee being an illegal alien, as far as Yang overbilling FDOT, the report itself is about 100 pages, and I am still in the process of going through that report.
But we don't know if that's the report that he actually was working on either, because at his suicide scene, there is an empty file folder and an empty yellow notepad. So whatever he was working on in the hotel isn't available anymore.
Hi, this is Gary Beckwith at SolarBus. I have two quick questions. Clint, have you considered or have you taken a lie detector test? And two, is there anything in the photos that are going to be released today that that reveal any new information about his death?
I've always been willing to take a polygraph, welcome it, and I haven't seen the photos. I don't know about that. You have to ask Brad that one.
Okay, yeah. I unfortunately have seen them. You know, folks out there may find even more in the photographs than I did, but there is at least one notable discrepancy with the photographs to the police report, at least one. Of course, the existence of the photos at all is in conflict with the police report, but there are certain elements that really don't make sense, including the detective Shannon Floyd, who took the photographs and who claimed that they wouldn't be available, says, for example, at one point in the report that there was a belt next to the tub that was apparently used as a tourniquet. The belt sat on a white towel. There was dried blood on the belt, but none was visible on the towel. As you will see in the report, there's a photograph of that towel and that belt, and there's blood all over the towel. Now, I'm not exactly sure of the significance of the blood on that towel, but the fact that the detective who made the most detailed report said that there was no blood on that towel, and yet there very obviously is, puts a lot of matters in question. Also released with those photographs was two receipts, a check-in and a check-out receipt from the Nights Inn Motel in Valdosta. The check-in receipt is dated June 29th, 6:54 p.m. The check-out receipt is dated June 30th, 6:44 a.m., as I recall. problem is, Raymond Lemmy was in Tallahassee on June 29th and the morning of June 30th, and kissed his wife, you know, goodbye. She's in the police report, is talking about he kissed her goodbye around 5:15 a.m. So the dates are completely off. I talk about that in detail in the report. So yeah, there are some troubling things in that information.
So then I guess I'm wondering if somebody could arrange to have a lie detector test take place. I think it would be a beneficial thing to all of us.
Note taken, and I agree.
Great idea.
Good PR, too.
I also agree.
Other questions?
Wow, I guess there's none.
Actually, I do. This is Phyllis Heaster of CountPaperBalance.com. Has anyone considered pursuing more of the medical examiner route? Because I know in Georgia, a really good medical examiner is Dr. Joseph Burton. Have you thought about getting a second opinion on the cause of death?
Body was cremated.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Yep.
All right. The other question I have, we're pursuing, in Georgia, we're pursuing Diebold pretty aggressively from a legal perspective. Was there any trail between Feeney and the software to either Diebold or ES&S?
I don't know. I only wrote the software for Feeney, so.
If there is, I have not yet found it, but one of the purposes, hopefully, of this call is to help the story get out there in a much broader way. I'm sort of a one-man band at bradblog.com and have only been able to look into so much of this story, which has been quite a lot, but I have not yet been able to find, I think you're asking about sort of direct ties between ES&S, Diebold, or the voting companies with Feeney. Is that essentially the question?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. No, I have not been able to find anything yet on that. I welcome the investigation of all of you guys here to help out in this thing. And I should also mention, by the way, on that Georgia issue, I had originally asked Clint when he told me about the Lemmy thing in one of our early interviews what the heck Lemmy was doing in Georgia. He told me that Georgia has no autopsy laws. That was his impression. And in other words, had Lemmy, for example, committed suicide in Tallahassee, there would have been a mandatory autopsy, but in Georgia, and Valdosta is a border town, essentially, in Georgia. It's a, sort of the first major town in Georgia next to Tallahassee. In Georgia, there's no autopsy law, so he killed himself, so the police say, and the body was shipped back. He was cremated, and there was not much more done about it.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
Well, one other thing is, have you considered using Florida Sunshine Laws to get access to more of the Tom Feeney data around what he did with the CD?
In truth, we don't know that Tom Feeney was ever given the CD. All we know is that Clint gave it to, that Clint claims to have given it to Mrs. Yang.
And she said she was going to give it to him.
What's that?
And she stated she was going to give it to him.
Okay. So we don't know after that. The trail runs cold as far as what happened to that CD and that documentation.
Dorothy Fadiman, independent filmmaker. I have a software question about vote switching, vote flipping. I was at the polls in Florida, and I was there when people began reporting that their votes for Kerry seemed to be going to Bush. And there was quite a fuss about that, and then it kind of quieted down. I began to investigate what was happening all over the country, and in Mahoning County, Youngstown area, I gather there were at least 20 machines on which that was happening. Clint, what I'd like you to talk about is whether or not when the program or the kind of program you created gets a quirk or a problem in it, that is the kind of thing that might then happen.
Well, that sounds like just sloppy programming to me, because no matter what you do on the screen, that's not what happens. what happens is underneath, and you can make that do anything you want. So I could switch your vote from Kerry to Bush, but I wouldn't have to show you it happening. I would just do it. In the program that I wrote, the person couldn't see anything. In fact, if you had an election supervisor and 10 witnesses standing behind you, you'd never know they switched the vote. All they did was hit a couple of random spots on the screen and hit submit, and it was done. Otherwise, it would look like just they were normally voting.
But might these machines, however, have had a problem since so many of them were making the same mistake?
Well, they might have had a problem.
Of revealing their programming.
I'm thinking the programming was intentional because all you're doing is adding one to a total. This isn't really hard programming. This is real simple stuff. So unless you made it overly complex, there's no reason for that to occur.
Jeff Staples, RadioLeft.com. As I understand it, it is only the top two vote-getters that would be flipped. That implies that if there's too large a distance between the two top candidates, that you couldn't do that and have it be believable.
Well, I don't know. In Florida, the exit polls show Kerry winning by 9%, and yet he never showed that in his actual votes. Do you believe it? That's the question.
But how far apart was it on Election Day?
I don't know. I would say the exit polls were probably correct. I mean, in the Ukrainian election, the exit polls showed, you know, the fellow who eventually won as leading the other guy by a certain margin. Well, he lost in the real election, but we screamed and yelled and said, well, the exit polls are correct, the election is wrong. They had the election again, and it turns out that that election came out exactly like the exit polls did in the first election. Here we just said, oh, well, exit polls are wrong. So I guess we don't care as much about here as we do about the Ukraine.
I just mentioned that a guy named Steve Freeman has done some extensive work on the exit poll discrepancies and the statistical impossibility of that, and we may want to schedule him for a future call because his story has never been seriously challenged, and people in America need to understand that the exit polls show Kerry won.
Helene from Boston.
Helene.
Do you know how old was Lemmy? Have you talked with his family about the cremation? Did he have cremation wishes? You know, how did they feel about that? How was that all arranged? And also, why wasn't Clint Curtis ever given a lie detector test? Because it seems like such an obvious thing. And is it easy to even get one? Who owns them? So that's a bunch of questions.
Let me try and jump in on a little bit of that. Actually, I think Lemmy, I'm not looking at my notes here. I believe he was, I want to say, 56 at the time he died. I hope I'm right about that. Something like that, 55, 56. He had, by the way, just returned from an Army Reserve weekend and had recently been given an award by the IG's office. The family was in complete shock. There was no sign that he would have done something like this. In fact,
daughter was about to be married.
That's right. In fact, his wife confirms in the police report that he had been working on a, quote, big case. And then, indeed, the suicide note that was left there unsigned says, refers to his wife Marianne, but Lemmy had only one child, a daughter, who was to be getting married in 2 months' time, and he never mentions her in that suicide note.
Well, wait, no, and have handwriting experts looked at the suicide note? But I'm talking also about the cremation stuff. He didn't have those wishes, you know, to be cremated. What did his family say about the cremation? Did the police just do it? All of that stuff.
No, I think that was at the family's request. I'm hesitant to report anything on the story that I don't have confirmed where possible. So you ask a good question. I presume, having talked to some of the family members, there was nothing expressed that they were unhappy about, you know, the cremation. So I believe it was done at their, I have to assume it was done at their request until I learn otherwise. But
has the handwriting note been analyzed to know that it was his writing?
Not to my knowledge, not by a handwriting expert, as far as I know, but the family members who I've spoken with have said that they generally believed that it was his handwriting. Mm-hmm. But it was not, as far as I know, analyzed, certainly not by the Valdosta police. There was a lot of stuff that does not seem to have been thoroughly analyzed by the Valdosta police, including the fact that the check-in, check-out receipt dates are completely off by a day. I mean, that just makes no sense, even if the hotel's credit card terminal, for whatever reason, had been misset, had the wrong date. It would seem to me that that the police could check with the merchant credit card processor and check to see when they received those transactions, you know, to see if the dates were correct. As far as I can tell, the Valdosta police never did that.
Well, either way, he shouldn't have had two of them.
Well, he might have, Clint, because from what I can tell, one is actually a check-in receipt. It's not signed by him, the check-in receipt, notably. You know, but this is how much you will be charged on your credit card, et cetera. The second one, then, seems to actually be the credit card processed and signed by Raymond Lemmy. So that, to me, makes sense that there would be two receipts.
So do we have access to the suicide note, and could we have it analyzed?
You will have access to both the photo shortly after we get off this call and I post my item. You will have access to a couple of photographs of the suicide note, and which are a little hard to read because of the lighting. However, I have a Xeroxed photocopy of that suicide note on which you can read the writing and the handwriting, and that will be posted in this story. I don't believe that's ever been posted on the net. It will be posted as within minutes after we get off this call.
Could I just go back to Clint Curtis and the lie detector test? Why hasn't that ever been done yet? And does anyone have access to that besides the police doing that polygraph stuff?
I'm sure we can find somebody qualified. Yes. By the end of the month, you will have lie detector results one way or the other. How's that sound?
Helene in Boston? Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to know whether there was, well, first of all, relating to the spread in Florida, somebody was asking about that. My memory is that Kerry was 3 percentage points down in the election and 3 percentage points above in the prediction. So I think it was a spread of 6 percentage points, but that's my memory. But the question I had is, what can we people here on the call do to promote the publicity? Because that's one of the things you said you were hoping to gain from this call. Do you have any thoughts about how we could do something to help you?
Is that for me or Clint?
Either one, both.
You know, I'd say, you know, for me, you know, picking up on the details of the story, which has, as I say, become rather broad, rather huge with a lot of elements, so it's hard to wrap your brain around. I have recently posted a summary, a general summary of the story, and then, you know, of course, a link to an index with all of the key articles. You know, learning about those yourself, pointing to those, you know, linking to those, even though some of them may be old. You know, get the story out there. Write about it on your blog. You know, if you'd like to speak with Clint about any of these things specifically, you can contact him, I guess contact me, and I'll try and put you in touch with him. You know, unlike, for example, let's say Jeff Gannon Gookert, Clint has been willing to talk to just about anybody who had any questions for him. He has not hidden behind anything. He gave a sworn affidavit. He showed up live in front of a hearing with the U.S. House Judiciary Committee members.
Can I just interrupt for one moment?
Yeah.
And ask you, why didn't Conyers ever publicize? They did publicize the triad problem, but the last I heard, they hadn't really publicized the Clint Curtis interview. Is that true?
Publicized the interview?
Well, Conyers was made an extensive report on the hearings. Did he ever report on the testimony by Clint Curtis?
I believe it's in the record in the transcript for the hearings that they had, but no, they have not yet made a public statement on it. My understanding is, one of the reasons is because Tom Feeney happens to sit on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee at this
right.
time, and the bar for ethics complaints of this type is very, very high, to the point that if they issue an ethics report, an ethics complaint against Feeney, and they are unable to meet the bar, and remember the bar is decided now by the majority, which happens to be the Republicans, they themselves can be held on ethics complaints.
Uh-huh.
So they're being, my sense is they're being extremely careful. I know that Clint has met with, has of course given that public testimony and has met with various staffers in both the Senate and the House on several occasions to give them information about this story.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But we
okay.
need more people digging, and the news needs to get out there to apply pressure to these folks to speak about this, to speak about it on both the Democrat side and on the Republican side. And
Well, that might be something we could do then, something to apply the pressure on Conyers Commission or something like that, do you think?
That would be good. I think, as I say, they can only do so much. I suppose if they are forced to answer publicly, then that might help, but they have a very high bar, and so, you know, more evidence, more details from everybody, and certainly once the mainstream media picks this up, I think then they'll have to give comment, as will Tom Feeney, who has so far been able to dodge. He did make some statements to MSNBC, which were very quickly disproven on the Brad blog, debunked on the Brad blog.
Brad, Roger King, media chair, Democrats Abroad Canada.
Yeah.
Picking up on that, getting in touch with the mainstream media and all that kind of stuff, who have you approached and what has been the reaction? Have people just said, oh, we're not interested, or they're looking for one more nugget that kind of pushes it into another realm, or what's your...
Yeah, my sense is, in truth, most of the mainstream media folks who I've spoken to have actually contacted me after I broke the story. There was one, I don't want to mention who it was, but a mainstream newspaper who I spoke with prior to releasing the story, as well as speaking to sources in Congress, because frankly, I thought this was an explosive enough story that I was happy to give it up to someone in the mainstream media.
Let them run with it, kind of?
Yeah, let them run with it, or
yeah.
keep it within the halls of a congressional investigation if necessary, rather than breaking it on my blog. So other than that, the mainstream media who have contacted me, and there have been many of them, I can't tell you completely why they haven't run with it. They seem to be very interested in it. They seem to be continually amazed by the material that I've been turning up and reporting on. I guess all you can ask yourself is, if you look at the body of work that I've done, the thousands and thousands of words I've written, including hard evidence, public documents, obtained from public records requests and court documents and so forth, you have to ask yourself, boy, if it was the other way around and this was a Democrat who had done what Curtis is charging Feeney with having done,
right.
would that be in the mainstream media? I have a feeling it would. So,
well, have you contacted anyone from the Democrats? Seeing as how I'm speaking from Democrats Abroad Canada, we do have some contact with some of the people. I just wonder, was the Kerry campaign approached? Was anyone in the Florida Democrats? What has the Democratic reaction been? Because I constantly get frustrated with the Democrats not jumping on some of this stuff more feverishly.
Well, join the club. But I have not personally contacted anybody, like, for example, the DNC. In general, the folks that I've spoken to have been congressional Democrats. I will leave it at that for the moment.
Helene in Boston. I'd like to know, because I have held back with really speaking to the people in the Democratic Party that I've been in contact with, because I felt like I hadn't heard enough corroboration, and nobody else was picking up on this, and maybe this isn't a substantive story. In other words, I just wasn't sure if the background information was sufficient for it to be picked up. But how can, you're saying that you have a lot of very hard stuff that we can use to back up our complaints and going to the people who are not publicizing it.
Yes.
Because, you know, it seems as if when nobody publicizes it, that maybe there just isn't enough of a substantive story there.
Yeah, well, if it's not reported by the New York Times, I guess it's not news. Once it is, then suddenly it becomes news. All I can tell you is that I have been searching for 3 months to find a hole in Clint Curtis's story. Now, we don't know. He may or may not be telling the truth about the vote rigging charges with Feeney, because for the moment there is no immediate hard, you know, videotaped proof of this occurring. The fellow, however, the executive secretary, Mike Cohen, who was at the meeting, has been removed from recently removed from the Yang headquarters, has been sent to a different job over at NASA. Sort of hidden. He used to be a liaison to the media and so forth. He's been taken out of sight. Basically, what I'm saying is I have not been able to find a hole so far in Clint Curtis's story, yet I have found hole after hole after hole in everything that Yang, Feeney, and their attorneys have had to say on this matter. And I should point out, because a lot of the media who have reported on this frequently quote Yang's attorney, Michael O'Quinn from Fowler and O'Quinn, it's important to point out that Fowler and O'Quinn used to be called Fowler, Barris, Feeney and O'Quinn. O'Quinn is, in fact, who happens to be Yang's attorney, is also Tom Feeney's old law partner and still a major contributor to Tom Feeney, as are the Yangs, you know, despite the fact that, for example, Feeney says he's had no connection to them since 2002. Well, guess what? Turns out, and we have the photographs, and it's even on Tom Feeney's website, Tom Feeney's campaign for 2004 run for Congress, his campaign headquarters are still, to this day, inside the Yang building. In May of 2003, again, I have the documents online, Yang threw him a private party and reception. That is online on the web, on somebody else's website with photographs of him there. The documents are there. Everybody, you know, on the Feeney Yang side has been shown to be wrong. And I remember when I first started reporting this story, I was warned that if anything Clint had to say, anything could be proven incorrect, then you have to throw out his entire story. Well, it seems to be sort of a one-sided thing in that regard, because item after item after item has been debunked by, you know, that Yang and Feeney and so forth have talked about, has been completely debunked. Does that mean we have to throw out the rest of their story when they deny that this vote rigging stuff actually happened? You know, there seems to be a double standard in that regard.
Brad, Roger in Toronto again, just, you've sort of indicated, it sort of does come down to one guy's testimony. I guess that, if there was a weakness to the whole thing, that's, you know, it's easy to just say, oh, this guy's lying or this guy's mistaken. Something you said at the beginning, though, Curtis was a lifelong Republican. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah, because you know that if this story does get traction, that's what the Republicans will go into character assassination mode. Has any of that happened so far? Have you had any threats? Have you had any anything that the people that have covered it, any character assassination type stuff? Or, like, have you done work with Republicans before? You know, that would be kind of a powerful, this is a guy who was on the Republican side and he's come forward.
Oh, no, I just voted Republican.
Okay, all right.
I never was, like, a campaign worker type guy or anything.
Okay.
As far as character assassination, yes, there has been plenty of Clint, you know, including, for a while after the story broke, the party line over Yang and Feeney and their attorneys was that Clint was a disgruntled employee.
And that's why you made that point about them throwing him a nice party.
Correct. And
yeah.
Did, again, the hard evidence, the card that they gave him signed by Mrs. Yang and Henry Nee, the spy, you know, both of whom said, Mrs. Yang notably, you know, said the door is open for you at any time. And the fact that he stayed 6 weeks after his original resignation would seem to indicate he wasn't quite as disgruntled as they said. We got that information out, and so they don't seem to use that disgruntled employee anymore. They have moved on to other sort of character smears, which have also been disproven, again, by hard evidence that's been posted at BradBlog.
And was the detective who was killed, was he, the investigator, he was just doing this alone, like there was nobody else involved working with him, or he didn't communicate anything to anyone, or?
Right. Officially, the investigation of Yang was killed. That's what he told me, is that there would be no official investigation. It had been stopped from the very top.
No, sorry, I'm talking about the guy who was murdered, or, you know, quote-unquote,
right.
Committed suicide.
Ray Lemmy.
Ray Lemmy, yeah. He was working on this alone? Like,
he was working on this alone.
Okay. No communication to anybody else, or?
I don't know.
Hmm.
He didn't tell me a lot. It was kind of that, you know, detective-type demeanor.
Right.
I ask the questions, you give me the answers, and then I go home.
Gotcha.
Sheila from Boston, this is a terrible question, so Clint especially, forgive me for asking it, but I feel that I must. I'm always wondering why they haven't killed you, Clint, to tell you the truth.
I've had some interesting things happen, but I'm still alive.
Yeah, I mean, but do other people wonder that? Do you think that? Are you afraid?
I worry about that.
Yeah, I worry about that a lot. Right.
Do you, Clint?
Not really. You just keep going until you don't.
Gary Beckwith at Solar Bus again. Clint, in regards to the software, I have a question. If software like the one that you proposed, then we should all note that it's possible that somebody else could have been approached in the same way that he was to write similar software, so we can't assume that what he did was actually the only one that may have been used. But if software like the one that you proposed was used, would it still exist on the voting machines today? Could it be written to erase itself after the election day? And to follow up on that, what would be needed to required to inspect these voting machines short of a lawsuit and a subpoena? Is there any Florida state statutes that allow for the inspection of these voting machines?
I don't know too much about the law and in regards to the voting machines. They could write it to eat itself, although Feeney's pretty arrogant. I'm not sure that he would really, you know, if the people writing the software are as arrogant as he is, then I'm pretty sure they'd just leave it there, because it's very tough to break down source code anyway. So even if you got the machine, you'd have to decompile it, you'd have to hopefully be able to find it, and it's 24 lines. Depending on how well they buried it, it could be a tough look.
You know,
so the code that you actually wrote did not include a self-erasing feature. It would still be on there if it was used.
Yes, if it was mine, well, see, they couldn't have used mine because mine did one race. The little prototype did one race.
Mm-hmm.
It was not set up to layer the races or anything like that, so they would have had to add more to it to bring it up. So at best, they would have just added the flipping part. But, I mean, it's very simple. I'm not the only guy in the world who could write this thing. So any computer-literate programmer they went to could have written the same thing.
So there's a chance that if this kind of program was used, that there's evidence of it still sitting right now as we speak on these machines.
If you can get it.
Jim Bryant with Democrats.com. I got a couple of questions here. First off, I would tend to think that would be more to their advantage to leave any such code in there, just be buried forever. That plus removing the code would actually make it look worse.
Well, you can make it eat itself. You could have a...
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you have a little module in there that does the flipping, gets activated a certain way, and then, you know, a month later, it disintegrates. Next election, you add a patch, you patch your stuff, it's back there.
Yeah. I have one other question. Have you ever heard of anybody that goes by the name of Blitz K or Blitzkrieg? White supremacists involved with writing voting machine software?
No idea.
In Florida?
Blitzkrieg?
Yeah. Doesn't mean anything? Okay, no. Thank you.
Sorry.
By the way, since Clint mentioned the arrogance of Feeney, it's either fun or disturbing to point out that yesterday Tom Feeney threw a fundraiser for his Feeney for Congress campaign. By the way, he ran unopposed in 2004, but raised a lot of money. Nonetheless, he threw a fundraiser yesterday called C'est la vie, Comrade Rather. So speaking of arrogance, for a guy who was representing and lobbying for a company which harbored a now-confirmed Chinese spy, and that company, by the way, Yang, still insists that Yang, that Ni never worked for them, despite the fact that I've posted on the Internet weekly time reports signed by Ni showing that he worked 40 to 60 hours a week at Yang. And the Florida IG's report has said he worked at Yang. They, to this day, still insist he never worked at Yang, but he's a Chinese spy. He was, Tom Feeney was their corporate counsel, and so to throw a C'est la vie, Comrade Rather party, is, ironic to say the least, and, of course, demonstrates just a bit of arrogance on Mr. Feeney's part, in my opinion.
And the owner's brother was thrown out of the country for spying.
Is Henry Ni still in the country?
Yes, actually talked to him about a week and a half ago.
What about?
Well, there was an investigator that was looking at something, and he wanted to know where he lived. So I showed him the house. And he knocked on the door, and lo and behold, Henry opens the door. So we talked to him and find out some interesting things, such as after talking to the FBI and the CIA and Homeland Security, according to Henry, he hasn't been interviewed by anybody.
I will also add that, because somebody had asked about the FBI previously, we posted it again at bradblog.com, email that was sent from a special agent at the Florida's Homeland Security Task Force, which was sent to Clint when he was making complaints all over the place, trying to get the attention of anybody on this story. He sent a note to those guys, and they wrote back, I believe his name was Tom. Oh, shoot, all of a sudden I'm blanking out on the name, but I posted the email at Bradblog, who had confirmed that, in fact, Yang was under investigation. Once this story broke, I believe rawstory.com followed up on that and got in touch with that agent who all of a sudden said, well, maybe it was a different Yang. So we don't know what the status of the FBI investigation is or isn't concerning Yang Enterprises at this time.
But they haven't talked to Henry.
Says Henry.
Of course, he also said that prior to his sending parts out of the country, he never had any dealings at all with anything, Defense Department or otherwise, and according to his bio that I have read, is it on your blog or somebody else's? He actually worked for a research company with the Defense Department. So, it's hard to say what Henry's really telling us. But he's not that hard to talk to if you want to go meet with him.
He's an American citizen?
No.
Illegal alien as of January 1, 2000.
He's an illegal alien. He was convicted of espionage.
Right.
And he's still in this country?
Right.
Yes, in fact, according to Henry, he thinks he's going to get a green card. He's been promised one.
And as well, Yang applied, petitioned on his behalf to the immigration services to help him get a green card. They say that he's just a family friend and that he was working, I've heard, there's been various stories that he was working at Yang for free just to keep up his computer skills. Now 40 to 60 hours a week for free is, I imagine his skills are very good by now.
Well, if you work on NASA projects, your skills get better.
Yes.
Was this after the convention?
NASA projects. at least, that's what Clint Curtis says. We know it's verified, however, that he was working on Florida Department of Transportation projects, because those are the weekly time reports that we've posted that have been signed by him.
Is he employed now?
He says he isn't.
There's a direct answer.
Hey, was that after the conviction?
What's that?
When he actually tried helping with the green card?
No, I believe that was actually before the
Was he being prosecuted at the time?
He was being, the sting itself was a four-year investigation that it took place, I want to say, 97 through 2001, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was 96 through 2000, something like that. Four-year investigation.
Okay, that's back when Katrina Leung's guy was operating as the liaison on Chinese affairs?
Not sure. There is information on the immigration.
By the way, when's her trial going to be anyway? It was supposed to be last year.
No idea on that.
Yeah.
But it's not as if Henry wasn't punished. He was given a $100 fine.
Jesus.
By the way, the maximum penalty that the Immigration and Customs Export Service wrote about when they wrote about the arrest of Ni, the 4 year sting, they said he faced up to, I believe it was $25,000 fine and 10 years in prison. And that, again, came from federal sources on their website, and we've posted that information on Bradblog.
Okay, more questions? Because our time's about to run out. Hearing none, I want to say thank you to Brad and to Clint for being our guests on this call. This was an amazing conversation. I want to thank Jeff Staples and Radio Left. This show will be rebroadcast today at 6 o'clock, so visit radioleft.com to listen to it again.
Eastern, 6 p.m. Eastern?
6 p.m. Eastern.
Brad, just one thing. All that evidence you said, is it all on your blog?
Pretty much everything I referred to is on the blog in some place or another. If you have any trouble finding anything, of course, let me know via email. Please be patient because I get mountains of it these days, but I'll try to keep an eye out for any questions that come in about Clint Curtis. You can get my email address off bradblog.com, and I will do my best to answer any questions and or help any of the media folks out there or even bloggers out there. Who are the media these days, hopefully get in touch with Clint himself if they have further follow-up questions that they want to ask. But, yes, I'll help you find whatever evidence and information that you need. We can also get in touch via phone if you contact me, if that's a little easier and more direct to get at specific things. Like I say, the good news is I'm willing to talk about anything. More importantly, Clint Curtis is available, unlike Jeff Gannon, to speak to any of the tough questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me also thank Ben Birch and the White Rose Society, whiterosesociety.org. This show will be archived there permanently, and we got 2,000 downloads for the last show, so I expect this will be replayed often. I want you all to be invited back for Blog Call 3 next Tuesday, March 15th. Same time, 1 p.m. Eastern, featuring John Byrne and Larissa Alexandrovna of RawStoryJot.com. John and Larissa are exposing how Tom DeLay's extravagant trips overseas were illegally funded by a charity called NCPPR, how NCPPR illegally raised its money by scamming the elderly with Social Security fright letters, and how right-wing lobbyist Jack Abramoff connects the two. Raw Story is one of the leading independent news sources online and has broken numerous investigative stories, including stories about Clint Curtis. Raw Story is also working with bloggers and the Progressive Radio to create a conduit of quick response news. So don't miss Blog Call 3. If you have comments or suggestions about Blog Call, please write me at democrats.com/contact. We are also looking for a volunteer to transcribe these calls. So if you have time for that, please let me know. I want to also thank the outstanding folks who are making Blog Call an important force in the blogosphere. That's Karen Altman and Tom Ball and Pat Barch and Jim Bryant, Noah Diamond, Ralph Drattman, Brad Friedman, of course, Ted Call, and Carolyn Kay.
This is Jeff Staples in the Radio Left Studios. You've been listening to Blog Call on RadioLeft.com.